I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to The Connection. Anthropologist Roy Richard Grinker comes from a family who believed that everyone has a little mental illness. His father, his grandfather, and great-grandfather were all psychiatrists. In fact, his grandfather, also named Roy Grinker, was a patient of Sigmund Freud and spent his career working to erase the stigma of mental illness. Grinker's book, Nobody's Normal, is about the seesawing history of stigma and acceptance when it comes to people who were seen as different. He writes about his daughter, who was diagnosed with autism back in the 1990s when it was considered a rare condition. Writing in the New York Times recently, Grinker took issue with Health and Human Services Secretary Kennedy and President Trump, who called autism a tragic epidemic that destroys families and a horrible crisis. Roy Richard Grinker joins us today to describe the progress made in understanding autism, overcoming the stigma of the diagnosis, and dispelling the myths about the causes. We'll also talk about how culture influences how we view what's healthy and what's not, and how what we call mental illnesses can be seen as an expression of human diversity, not something to be ashamed of. Our guest, Roy Richard Grinker, is a cultural anthropologist at George Washington University and joins us today on The Connection. Nice to have you with us on the show.
Yeah, nice to see you.
You know, we spoke about 5 years ago when your book first came out, and you described the progress that was being made in terms of understanding autism and neurodiversity, that there was less stigma compared to when your daughter was diagnosed in 1994. How would you describe the mood, the environment today?
I think we've made tremendous progress. I know that, you know, as a teacher, I've seen a major shift. When I first started teaching, my students didn't come and talk to me about their problems, what support needs they might have had. And today, there are students who will stand up in a room of 200 or 300 students and say that they have autism or they have ADHD. And, you know, to get to that point takes a lot of work. And we don't want to go back to a time where people were hiding their needs. And so, you know, I'm almost a little jealous when I see people today, because I think about when my daughter was so young and how scary all of these terms were that we used.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about today, and I don't want to obviously spend the whole hour talking about Kennedy and Trump, but I wonder in the kind of message that they're putting out, that there's something about people with autism, that these are damaged people, that it's something to be eradicated. Are you concerned that that's going to roll back the clock on some of the progress that has been made?
Sure. I think we have to be really careful anytime there's a single person or one or two people with an outsized voice, a big platform that, you know, may be speaking not out of expertise, but out of other interests, like their own personal views or politics. And, you know, when we think about autism over the past several decades, we're talking about tens of thousands of people who've dedicated their lives to studying this. And their voices can be, you know, basically invisible when you have somebody with a huge platform that's out there speaking. So we do have to be careful. And there was a time, a long time ago, in the 1960s and 70s, when, as I write in the New York Times piece, Bruno Bettelheim, who was a self-proclaimed psychologist, had that kind of outsized influence. And what he said went. You know, that was the gold standard, and he believed that autism was caused by poor mothering.
In fact, he called them, I believe the term was refrigerator mothers, that they were so cold and uncaring that they literally gave their child autism because of their coldness.
Yeah, his theory is a little bit convoluted, but it basically what Bettelheim said was that these were mothers who wished their children dead. And the children could somehow understand that unconsciously. And to protect themselves, they retreated into what he called a fortress. And that fortress blocked their communication with the outside world. I mean, this really didn't have any basis in any evidence. These were, by all accounts, loving mothers who had kids who had developmental disabilities.
I mean, imagine being a mother told that. I mean, how horrifying that is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the key here to remember is that whenever we talk about mother blame, whether it's saying, you know, we blame you because you took such, you know, this pain reliever when you were pregnant, or because you did this or that while you were pregnant, when we blame mothers or we blame parents, they're sometimes only too ready to accept that blame. I mean, I know what it's like to be a parent. You're always a little afraid if you're doing something wrong.
Indeed. Right? Yeah, exactly.
This precious child who you love more than you ever thought you could love anything in the world, and they are vulnerable and they depend on you. And so in a sense, there's a danger not only to speaking about mother blame, you know, just in stigmatizing people, but because parents are vulnerable.
Well, I wonder too, and this is actually quoting from RFK about autism destroying families. One of the things he said, talking about children with autism, will never pay taxes, never hold a job, never play baseball, never write a poem or go out on a date. I mean, it seems he has a very narrow an extreme view of what autism is. And from your work and a lot of other people's works, it's this giant, you know, it's more than one little narrow description of a certain kind of behavior.
Well, it is a description of people in the negative, what they can't do, what they won't do. So there are children and adults who have pretty pronounced and profound needs. They need to be cared for 24/7. So yes, maybe they're not going to be out in the workplace, but what can they do? They take care of animals in a residential facility. They are capable of love. I mean, even you talk to parents who have kids with really profound intellectual disability, and they know, they'll tell you their children love them. Their children connect with them. They're important to them. They're important parts of their lives. They may volunteer. They grow. They change over time. And they become people who are capable of many things. We could say about each of us that there are many things that we will never be able to do.
Indeed.
Whether it's you or whether it's me, right? I like to focus on what people can do. If you say they never can do something, well, then what are you supposed to do? Just give up and not provide care and support? The goal should not be trying to find somebody to blame, but trying to improve the lives of people so they can build a meaningful existence.
What do you think, though, explains the increase in numbers of people who are diagnosed with autism? Going back to when your daughter was first diagnosed, when it was considered pretty rare, I checked some CDC numbers, and 1 in 31 8-year-old children have an autism spectrum disorder, which is pretty shocking when you just look at it on paper. How do you understand that change?
You're asking a question that actually takes a long time to answer. And that's perhaps why sometimes it's unsatisfying to people. You know, we would like to say, oh, well, it's just this one thing, or it's just this other thing. But in fact, there are many variables that act in concert. One of the key points that I make in the New York Times piece, and I also write this in Nobody's Normal, is that we can't compare rates from one decade to another decade to another decade as if what we're comparing is exactly the same thing. So, I mean, if you were to take something like obesity, high blood pressure, diabetes, those we think of as medical conditions that have, you know, a real number in nature that defines them. But in fact, those numbers have shifted from decade to decade and decade. I have high blood pressure now. I would not have had high blood pressure 50 years ago because the numbers wouldn't have indicated that I did. And so what has happened with autism is that we've broadened the diagnostic categories and the diagnostic criteria so much that it's, you know, some people think it's almost a meaningless category now because there's so many people that are included. Right. But, I mean, at the risk of going on too long, I mean, I would like to just make the point that when autism first appeared in the diagnostic manual of the American Psychiatric Association in 1980, few children qualified. And few children today would qualify.
because we've enlarged in the definition, probably because we know more about what autism is and isn't?
I don't know that it's that we have a better idea of what autism is or isn't. It's that we have redefined what it is.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a different way of I mean, maybe I'm wordsmithing a bit here, but basically we're including people in that category that never would have been there before. And that includes people with identifiable genetic conditions like Down syndrome or tuberous sclerosis or Fragile X. Those kids would never have had a diagnosis with autism until recently.
Do you think it's too broad a definition, that it's kind of lost its meaning?
Well, I can't say that it's too broad a definition, because when those kids now are getting these secondary diagnoses of autism, it's for a reason, and it's for their benefit. It's so that you can get a better service for them, a more sort of targeted classroom placement. A lot of people today who have a diagnosis of autism that provides them special education services in the public schools in the U.S. would not actually qualify for autism in a research protocol, but they have that diagnosis to help you. I mean, basically, this is a point that needs to be made about all diagnoses, whether it's having a diagnosis of an infection or a cancer or depression or autism. A diagnosis is only worth what it gives you. And that's why we, you know, we have clinicians who we hope we have good clinicians who make good judgments. That's how they make the judgment between what is sadness and what is clinical depression, between what is the anxiety that we might feel maybe walking down a street we're unfamiliar with or driving in traffic, that normal anxiety that keeps us alert, and the anxiety that is debilitating and warrants something. So where does shyness become autism? Where does depression, sadness become depression? And when does normal anxiety become something that's a disorder? That's a clinical judgment that a doctor, an expert, somebody in the healthcare industry makes in order to provide you with some kind of service.
Well, we're almost up on a break here. It's also how you get the insurance companies to pay for that service, correct? You need a diagnosis in order to get the coverage.
Yeah, and actually that was part of the logic of building the first DSM, modern DSM, the 1980 DSM-3,
the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual.
Yeah, putting those, because the only statistics really are the numbers that get provided to the insurance company.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation with anthropologist Roy Richard Grinker. And we're talking about the fact that he has a particular interest in what is considered normal and not normal, the role of culture when it comes to understanding things like mental illness. And he is a cultural anthropologist at George Washington University. Much more to talk about after this very short break. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with anthropologist Roy Richard Grinker, talking about undoing the stigma of mental illness, why focusing on things like difference is better than focusing on disability. I just have a couple of more questions about autism, because it is so much in the news, and I think there is so much confusion. Because I think for parents, and you hear this anecdotally, they have a child, they take them in for their vaccine, and then a month or two or maybe 6 months later, their child stops talking, or they see these dramatic changes in their behavior, in their own mind, cause and effect. Do you understand why a parent might do that?
Yeah, the vaccines that children receive, which are so important and life-saving, they are given in early childhood, because that's the time when they're best administered and where they have the best effect. But developmental disorders also emerge in early childhood. And so there is this occasional association that people will make, and they say, well, it was around that same time that this happened. And so what looks to be causal is in fact coincidental.
Right. Meaning it just happened to have happened.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of the classic example in in science, when people talk about the difference between correlation and causation, is the example of two things that increase at the same time every year, which is ice cream consumption and crime. They both increase during the summer. But it's not that there's a causal relationship. Ice cream consumption doesn't cause crime. Crime doesn't cause increased ice cream consumption, but they do occur at the same time. And so that kind of coincidence is something that anti-vaccine activists have drawn on for a long time. I mean, there have been anti-vaccine movements well before the current one, all the way back to the late 1700s. Actually, no, probably, yeah, late 1700s when the smallpox vaccine was introduced in the United States. And so we see periods of time where anti-vaccine movements emerge, and they're usually in relation to children, and this notion that the pure, innocent child's body is somehow being poisoned or tainted by government interference and government mandates.
So that's just kind of a powerful narrative. Let me ask you
It's very
though.
powerful, but let me just add
No, go
that
ahead. Go ahead.
the child is this incredibly powerful symbol of vulnerability everywhere in the world. And so we see it not only in relation to anti-vaccine movements, but to other kinds of issues, like rumors in developing countries that industrialized nations are harming their children and want to harvest their organs, rumors of conspiracies to kill poor people, rumors of conspiracies to alter the reproductive levels of certain members of a community. So the child is something that really we need to focus on when we think about how certain government discourse has the power to make us afraid.
Do you think it's human nature to look for someone or something to blame if something goes wrong?
Well, most societies in the world do not have an idea of chance or luck. They blame something, you know. The oldest man in the village dies, and the survivors say, "Why did he die? Who killed him? Was it a witch? It was a god." And people say, "But he was the oldest man in the village." And they say, "Well, he was the oldest man yesterday too, and he didn't die yesterday. Why did he die today?" So we always look for things. I think that we actually in the United States are one of the few places that kind of accept the idea of coincidence and misfortune and luck, and we have conditions that we accept exist without a cause. I will just say that all of the conditions that are in the DSM, the American Psychiatric Association's manual, there are only a few that have a cause. Almost everything is of unknown cause, right? Whether it's depression, schizophrenia. I mean, we have clues, genetic loading, different types of risk factors that are associated with them, but they're of unknown cause. The only things that have a cause, off the top of my head, are like delirium associated with alcohol abuse, because you know, or substance abuse, because you know the substance abuse caused it, or prolonged grief disorder, which you know is caused by somebody dying, or post-traumatic stress disorder, which is caused by a traumatic experience. But the other 800 or however many conditions are idiopathic. The idiopathic, the term that experts use to mean of unknown cause.
Well, let me ask you then, why you think this belief that vaccines cause autism is so stubborn? And I'm thinking of Andrew Wakefield. He wrote this article in The Lancet about 12 children who had symptoms of autism. It turns out that the article was bogus. He misrepresented the findings. Lancet retracted the article. Wakefield lost his medical license. He's been repudiated by mainstream organizations, and yet, you know, he still seems to have influence over this conversation. Do you understand why?
I think there are many falsehoods that hang on and linger with us, including Bruno Bettelheim's idea of refrigerator mothers, which reared its head when our daughter was having issues with her development in the 1990s. At the risk of being cliche, Mark Twain had this famous line in which he said that a falsehood can travel halfway around the world before the truth even puts its shoes on. It takes a long time to dispel certain kinds of rumors, and there's really nothing we can do about it except to keep working at it and keep trying to hear a multiplicity of voices rather than rely on just a small number.
And the desire for an answer, the desire for something simple to explain this phenomenon. I mean, I can relate to that.
Well, I think that the growth of diagnostic terms like ADHD and autism, depression, whatever other terms you might want to bring up that are meaningful to you, are actually a sign of progress because they help us frame our understandings of a behavior or something that's not going as we expected it to go. So, there are many people who get diagnosed with autism today at age 40 or 50 or 60. And that's not to be in a special education
No,
classroom. They're 40,
no.
50, or 60. Then what purpose does it serve? It serves the purpose of helping you understand yourself, why you never understood social cues or nuances in sarcasm or irony. It helps you to explain to other people things that they might see as unusual. And in some cases, of course, it can drive a service. And I tell the story in Nobody's Normal of one of my freshman students who told me that the best day of her freshman year was when she was diagnosed with ADHD. And you could say, well, doesn't that sound bad, right? Doesn't that sound negative? You got diagnosed with a mental illness. And she said, no, her parents always thought she was lazy and not smart. And they thought she didn't work hard enough. And as a child, you can't really go to a doctor by yourself. But once she gets to college, she goes and sees a psychologist. She gets got diagnosed with ADHD, and she says it was the first time in her life that she felt that somebody didn't think she was stupid or lazy or didn't work hard enough, that she was smart, that she was capable, she just needed a little support. That framework of ADHD has given her opportunities to grow emotionally and academically that she never would have had before. And it's not just that this woman was strong and acting independently and resilient. It's also that she is in a society now that gives us the possibility, makes available that diagnosis, and makes available accommodations that are associated with the diagnosis.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Roy Richard Grinker, and he is a cultural anthropologist at George Washington University. He has written a couple of books, including Nobody's Normal, How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. This is such an interesting time because there's a TV show on Netflix called Love on the Spectrum, which is about people with autism and looking for love and breaking up and going on dates, and you meet them and you meet their families. I have to say it's a terrific show. There's also another show on Netflix called Extraordinary Attorney Wu, who is also someone with autism. There are also a couple of detective shows that star a detective with autism, one called Patience on PBS. And apparently the actress who plays Patience has autism. And that's from another show that was on French TV called Astrid. So while we have this kind of pushback coming from the administration, we see in the larger culture this embrace of all the diversity of autism. I find it just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I do too. Though I sometimes get concerned that it creates a stereotype that the person with autism is a highly verbal, speaking, intelligent person that with lots of family support. Because you see, really, in Love on the Spectrum,
Yeah,
you
these are
see some
amazing
very,
families. Yeah.
loving, supportive families. Not everybody in the world has that. Not everybody in the world who has autism has the kinds of economic resources those families have. And in addition, not everybody has the cognitive abilities that these folks have. So, by the way, my daughter loves the show, Love on the
Yeah.
Spectrum. She does. But
Do you love the show?
she I like the show too. She likes it for her own reasons.
Sure.
She's not because she's interested in finding love on the spectrum, but you know she loves the way that some of the people interact with their animals, and
Right.
she loves the way they interact with their various narrow interests and so on. But so I think that this is a, you know, it's really positive that we have these representations. We just can't lose sight of the higher support needs of many people with autism that, you know, are not able to go on dates, right? They're able to do lots of other things, but they're not able to go on dates or do surgery like the show The Good Doctor.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
To give you
it's a pretty long
another thing.
list of people. Exactly. You've done some
But
work.
you know what?
No, go ahead.
I'm
Go ahead.
sorry.
No,
I'm
go
sorry.
ahead.
It's just that a lot of people don't know this. The Good Doctor actually was originally a Korean show.
Oh, well,
And
you've
it,
done
and
some
it,
research in Korea, right?
yeah, I've done a lot of research in Korea. I actually feel somewhat responsible for helping to, you know, in my own way, increase the prevalence of autism there. When we first started doing research there, doctors said, "Oh, you're not going to find any autism. We,
Yeah.
it's a, just basically non-existent here." And we went in and we said, "Yeah, there's like no mention of autism in the records of the schools." So we did a what's called a total population study, where we looked at 56,000 kids, 8 to 12, in a city near Seoul, and we found a prevalence rate of 2.64%. Two-thirds of these kids had never had any kind of special need identified before. They were kind of muddling through school. And at that time, when we published this in the American Journal of Psychiatry in 2011, it was the highest autism rate that had ever been reported
Wow.
anywhere in the world. And it was the first study ever done in Korea. But at that time, the CDC statistics were not even close to that, and people thought, you know, some people thought it was really a kind of absurdly high figure, and we don't think that today anymore. But the result of this was that autism gained traction in Korea. Schools started to screen for it. They started to train teachers to provide appropriate services. And over time, particularly with the growth of media representations of autism, the kinds of things that started out in the early show, The Good Doctor, and then got, you know, adopted into Hollywood, and then later with shows like The Extraordinary Attorney Woo, you see autism becoming now the second most common diagnosis in school systems.
That's fascinating. Sort of taking all the things that we've been talking about over the last 30, 40 minutes, then, I mean, from your perspectives, is the goal in understanding autism, treating autism, identifying autism to reduce suffering? I mean, is that you think your goal, and should that be our goal?
Well, that is the goal that my grandfather talked about and my father talked about. The goal is always to reduce suffering, because human beings suffer.
Yes.
We all suffer, and we're always going to be on some spectrum. Now, whether that spectrum means that our sadness becomes clinical depression or our shyness is autism, you know, that's up to people and the services and the clinicians that they are encountering. But the goal is to make people feel better. I mean, I don't see anything. There was a time in World War II where the generals didn't want any psychiatrists to be near the battlefield. And one general said, "I don't want any psychiatrists coming in and making our boys sick."
Interesting. And your grandfather was a psychiatrist in the
And my
military.
grandfather, yeah,
Yeah.
well, there was some resistance against it, that he was going to somehow make people sick. And to some extent, he did, in the way, I mean, not literally, but he helped to construct this notion of post-traumatic stress disorder to understand why certain groups of people in war experienced such trauma that they were debilitated and they could no longer carry on, both with their, you know, military service, but even had difficulty in their personal lives. And so he, you know, they called it, eventually after the 1970s, it became post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
And what's the purpose of being diagnosed with that? It's again to provide care and to reduce suffering. Look, if we have to classify, we have to label, right? If I didn't, we couldn't even communicate. We couldn't do anything in the world. I'd see you on the street and I'd say, "Marty, how's the large formless blob today?" And you'd answer, "It's large and it's without form." And the conversation would end and
Some
we
days
would go
do
on
feel
our
like
separate
that.
ways.
Yes, exactly. I'm thinking though, and I'm looking at the clock here. You tell an interesting story about your work in Namibia, a young boy living in his village who, at least from the outside, looks like he's got autism.
Yeah.
How does his village, his family, how do they deal with him?
Well, he's had his suffering. This is in the Kalahari Desert. This is a group of people called the Zhonghuasi. And they he's been bullied, but he gets protected and he has certain skills. Like he remembers where everything is. He knows where the goats are any time of day. And he also can find anything that somebody's left, like they've lost their knife or a bag out in the forest and in the desert, and he has an ability to locate these things. He has incredible vision. He doesn't have a diagnosis of autism, though to me as a non-clinician he has all the signs of it. But I loved the fact that despite his suffering, he's productive and he's included in his family's life. And there's another person in the, if we have time, I could love to tell you about one more person in that village.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll pick up on that
Perfect.
after that break. And again, our guest is cultural anthropologist Roy Richard Grinker. And we've been talking about some of the work that he's been doing around the world. He mentioned South Korea. We're talking now about Namibia. He is a cultural anthropologist at George Washington University, wrote a book called Nobody's Normal: How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. Also wrote a book called Unstrange Minds: Remapping the World of Autism. We're covering a lot of territory here on The Connection. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guest is Roy Richard Grinker. He's an anthropologist with a particular interest in how different cultures and different time periods view what's considered normal and how they treat so-called mental illnesses. Okay, back to Namibia and this village and this other person that you mentioned.
Yeah, well, so the perspective of the anthropologist is usually to look at how we construct different ideas of what is true or what we accept to be true. And so there was a man that I met in Namibia, in the Kalahari Desert, who gets treated for schizophrenia in a small town where there's a clinic. And he's on the books as a person with schizophrenia, and he receives an antipsychotic medicine. And he receives this antipsychotic medicine once a month, and he gets his pills. He walks 12 miles
Wow.
each way, and he is considered to have schizophrenia. Now, back in his village, again, 12 miles away, they don't have a word for schizophrenia. They believe that he's the random victim of supernatural malevolence for a crime that somebody in the past committed. And so they don't hold him responsible. Are they afraid of him when he's not on his medicines? Yes, because he can be a little scary. Do they think that he is sick? Yes, but they don't blame him for it. And it's fascinating to me how 12 miles separate a person. In one place, the disease is thought to be contained within the person, and it's called schizophrenia. And in the other place, just 12 miles away, it's thought to be something that he's a victim of, and he should be cared for and supported, and that it's not his fault, and it's not something that is really an individual responsibility. And most of the stigma that we still have about mental illness gets concentrated throughout the world, actually, gets concentrated in conditions that imply a lack of control or responsibility of the self.
it makes me think of the time when we used to institutionalize people with mental illness. And then we had in the 1970s, this whole 80s deinstitutionalization where we closed down these institutions. I was a case manager. I used to go visit people in places like Pennhurst here in Philadelphia. And they were supposed to live in the community among us. We found that that didn't work out, and now we see so many people with mental illness who are homeless and on the streets of cities and communities across the country. I mean, it seems we have this, we don't know what to do with these people and where they belong and how to support them.
Yeah, the idea of deinstitutionalization was a good one, and it came out of the last act that John F. Kennedy signed before he was assassinated, the Community Mental Health Care Act, 1963. But the funding wasn't there locally for it. And so what we have now is a situation where people with serious mental illnesses are constantly mobile. They're always moving from the hospital to the emergency room, to the prison sometimes, from the prison to a halfway house, then to homelessness, and then back to the hospital. And with each institution wanting to just push them and get rid of them and push them on to the next place. And so there's this constant motion that does not help people with serious mental illnesses who then have very little stability and particularly socially don't have that stability.
But I would think many families, my own included, have serious mental illness within the family. You would think that that would erase some of the stigma because we know these people. Once you know people, then hopefully your attitude towards them and their condition becomes much more benign.
One would hope so.
Yeah.
It's when we look back historically, though, you know, we see that cancer was stigmatized.
That's right.
One of my best friends didn't even know that his mother died of cancer until 8 years after she died, because it was hidden both from him and even from her. The writer Susan Sontag studied some doctors and oncologists in New York who said that most patients that had cancer didn't know they had cancer, that they wouldn't tell them. Wow. And obituaries used to say that the person died after a long illness. But cancer was something that you whispered. Think about the stigma associated with HIV/AIDS. Or, you know, even earlier than that with leprosy and other conditions. And so, it's not surprising that we stigmatize. Human beings exclude. They include and they exclude. And so we never can give up. There is always an effort that we have to make, those of us who are interested in doing it, to find ways not to marginalize or exclude people, and to incorporate them into their communities and to give them a chance at building a meaningful life.
Do you think we exclude because we're afraid we might catch I'm using that metaphorically, but we might catch what they have that we don't, you know, we're afraid of them and we're afraid of what it might mean about our own mental health. As you say in your book, nobody's normal. Yeah. I mean, we're all struggling with something, right?
Well, I think that there's a particular desire for exclusion in capitalist societies where the ideal person is autonomous, independent, totally responsible for themselves. And so I think that over the past few hundred years, as capitalism has emerged in North America and Western Europe, we've tended to stigmatize those who don't fit that kind of capitalist ideal, and we don't value the person who's dependent. I think that's just a particular, it's not saying that capitalism causes mental illnesses, right, but capitalism creates the conditions for certain forms of exclusion.
Kind of like survival of the fittest?
I would hesitate to talk about that. What I would say is that every society has a sense of good and bad and normal and abnormal, and they usually map onto each other, right? That the abnormal is bad and the normal is good. Now, the man, Tomzo, in the Kalahari Desert, he is potentially someone who could be excluded, but not because he lacks productivity, not because he can't do a job, but because people might be afraid of him if his psych if his delusions and hallucinations come back. But what we see in the beginnings of the asylum culture of Western Europe in the 1700s and the 1800s, where all these residential, I mean, terrible conditions, these asylums were being built, is that the mandate for those asylums was to take care of the idle, the people who didn't work. And those were often people with very serious physical disabilities or mental disabilities. But it wasn't framed as, let's isolate these people who we're afraid of. It was, let's isolate these people who aren't contributing to any economic growth and are basically draining the resources of the family.
Do we also ostracize people because of things like sex and race?
We do. Those become other forms of exclusion. And they're all the these are all what we're talking about here are all the different ways in which power gets exercised in a society to try to make it the way that a group of people wants it to be, right? So, if we were to look at race and autism, they intersect. How do they intersect? In the 1970s and 1980s, black children were not getting diagnosed with autism, even if they had the identical symptoms as their white counterparts. So the white kid was getting called autistic, the black child was being called conduct disorder
Oh,
or
wow.
emotionally disturbed. And not only does that, totally change the trajectory of the services and treatment, but think of how a child feels about him or herself when they're classified in, as bad people, as opposed to, that their conduct is disordered, as opposed to that they have some sort of developmental disability like autism.
You have mentioned your grandfather, and you come from a family of 3 generations of psychiatrists. Your great grandfather, as I understand it, and as you wrote about it, believed that people with mental disorders were biologically inferior, that insanity was caused by, quote, that hallucination called love. Whereas your grandfather, his
And well, and
son,
also shopping, by the way.
oh, and shopping, right? Love and
He
shopping.
thought shopping was definitely linked to mental illness.
Maybe Amazon shopping. I do not know. But your grandfather, who you mentioned earlier, has really dedicated his life to working to erase this stigma and dealt a lot with, as you say, veterans who were dealing with some of the traumas of war. So it's interesting to look at one family, one generation to the next, to see this really powerful shift.
Yeah, I think the shift was one that my grandfather shared with many other people as the ideas about eugenics were eliminated. But I think that my great grandfather was living at a time when in the early 1900s, where there was a big growth in population in Chicago. People were moving to cities. And a lot of the people who were moving to cities were people who had lost social supports elsewhere and they were looking for some place to go. And so there was this sense that there was an epidemic of mental illness in Chicago
Wow.
because you had so many people who were coming alone and living alone and struggling. There are always periods of time where there are fears that there's an epidemic of something. And one of the first epidemiologic studies of mental illness in the country was in Chicago around 1920 that showed that the closer you got to a city, the more mental illness you found.
Wow. I mean, this also was a time of great immigration, which of course can cause a lot of dislocation among the populace and introduce something very new to the culture.
And as one result of this fear of the cities, there were people like the Kellogg brothers, the two brothers that started the cereal company, who founded a rural sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, where they said, you can escape from the city and you can come out here and you can be, live in purity. And they also felt that there was more sex in Chicago than there was outside of the city. And they developed this concoction of very bland foods that they thought could reduce one's sexual appetite. No sugar, dried oats, grains, things like that. And they marketed it as granula until they were sued for copyright infringement, and then they changed it to granola. And today we have granola
What should we
that we
do?
eat. And when we're eating the granola, you may not want to think about this, but that comes from a time when people thought there was an epidemic of new mental illnesses in the city.
Well, and then there's Mr. Graham Cracker, right, who was
The same
appalled
Sylvester
by
Graham.
masturbation, believing that this
Yes.
Graham Cracker would help to solve, I guess, reduce some of those sexual urges.
Well, and also, preserve the nation, which was falling into disrepair as the result of that. And he advocated also for children's uniforms to have no pockets in school, because then
Oh, because you wouldn't want to
they
put your
couldn't
hand in the
they couldn't get they couldn't get close to doing that horrible thing. There were other efforts to do this in addition to the famous Graham and Kellogg that are not so famous to try and mitigate this. And we see at various periods of time, and especially in the 20th century, and especially when there are epidemiologic studies, this fear of an epidemic. The 1950s saw two major studies. One they called the Midtown Manhattan study. Obviously, it was in Midtown Manhattan. The other was Stirling County in Canada. And they both showed significantly higher rates of mental illness than anybody had ever expected before. And, there became this what was reasonable and logical to them at the time, this fear that mental illness was rampant.
Wow. Well,
And of course it was, but it wasn't being diagnosed.
I'm looking at the clock here, but I'm also wondering, I mean, we have lived through a COVID pandemic. Maybe it's too early to sort of know the kind of impact it might have had on our mental health. Anything that you see?
Well, I can talk about the pandemic specifically in relation to autistic kids, okay?
Please do.
Which is that some autistic kids did very poorly during the pandemic because they lost the structure of their school day and of their services they were receiving. Others did extremely well because they didn't have to deal with the stress and the bullying of the school day, and they were able to actually achieve things that they hadn't achieved before. The pandemic is something that affected people in very different ways. So, as you say, it's too early to know, but sorting these things out is really a difficult task. Why is it that one child did worse during the pandemic with autism and the other did better? Variables, there are many variables, including whether the parents were at home, whether the parents had two jobs that they had to work at and the kid was left alone, or whether the child had the social supports that they needed. But it is true that the pandemic had a profound effect on kids with autism.
We're almost out of time here, but I just want to squeeze one more thing in that just crossed my mind as I was preparing for the interview, which is about language. How more and more you hear people describing themselves saying, I'm a little bit on the spectrum, or I have a little OCD. Do you see that as well?
I do. And some people that I talk to see it as a problem. They're like, well, OCD is a really serious, condition. Why would you say if you're just, you're a neatnik that you are a little OCD? Or why would you say you have PTSD from getting a bad grade on that economics exam? I actually, though, think it's a good thing, because when we use these terms, we disarm its power to hurt. We disarm its power to stigmatize. And that is what autistic self-advocates want to do. When they talk about autism, they want to own it. They want to be able to define it in their terms and not have some politician or somebody else define it, or even, an anthropologist or a doctor. But to say nothing about us without us, we can decide how we want to define ourselves.
Roy, Richard, Grinker, we got to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And he is a cultural anthropologist at George Washington University. And thank you for joining us on The Connection. It airs every Friday and Sunday at noon. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Debbie Builder produces the program. Al Banks, our engineer today. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for